Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme, 1 year of Donald Trump.
You'll be so proud of your president. You'll be so proud. It's been an amazing period. And I love this country. Thank you. Thank you.
12 months ago, Donald J. Trump was sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. The 2016 race to the White House was one of the most divisive campaigns in modern American history. And at the end of it, it was clear that there were two visions for what country the United States wanted to be. 1 year on, we assess the current state of American cities under Trump and ask if there's perhaps a silver lining. Are cities taking charge of their own futures? All that coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to this week's episode of The Urbanist. With many people still shell-shocked, in his first few weeks in office, he signed an executive order banning citizens from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen from entering the US. He also promised to halt the entries of refugees and asylum seekers to the country too. Then, before the world stage, he announced that the US would be pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. But as the federal government went into total disarray, cities started to emerge from their gloomy mood. After all, these were discussions that had been taking place in the corridors of City Hall, offices of lobbyists, and on the streets for many years. Donald Trump has forced mayors to take a leadership role in a way that we haven't seen in a very long time, even if he occasionally refuses to meet them. Otis Rolley is a regional director for North America at 100 Resilient Cities. He joined me earlier from Washington, D.C., where he's attending the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We started by talking about the current state of the relationship between Trump's administration and U.S. cities.
There are definitely opportunities for collaboration, but it has been a mixed bag. There have been challenges in terms of the values that the cities hold versus the administration on some key issues around environmental protection and climate change. But there's also, I think, consistency and areas of agreement around the issues of infrastructure investment and economic development and the ability and role of government to play a very active role in helping to bring jobs to our cities and to our nation. So I think in some ways it has been a mixed bag. But cities have really been banding together and thinking through how to best coordinate and collaborate with the federal government to try to advance where there are areas of agreement and alignment.
Well, perhaps we could just throw out a few of those key issues, really, and see what your thoughts are on and how collaboration could happen. Because, first of all, on the infrastructure side, well, many of the cities, I guess, are also thinking about infrastructure in light of, you know, making sure that they are resilient in the face of floods and threats, which are connected in many people's minds with climate change. Now, you have a president who says there is no climate change, this is all a fraud. How does that conversation go to a positive place, and if you think there is some possibility of joined up thinking there?
Whether or not the administration calls it climate change, you have seen through FEMA and through NOAA and the administration itself an acknowledgement of the weather disturbances, as they may frame them, and the issues and damage, economic damage, and damage to persons that it has caused and will continue to cause. And so, you know, the facts in regards to the increase in temperature and the increase in floods and the increase of some of the 100-year weather incidents that are happening much more frequently than within the 100-year cycle is undisputable. And so whether they choose to call it climate change or not, they have recognized that these things are occurring. As it relates to those issues in and of themselves, I think there is the opportunity for both the cities and the federal government to work together around looking to do things to mitigate for those weather disturbances and those increased frequency of those weather disturbances. The federal government, even fairly recently, the head of FEMA, the administrator of FEMA, was tweeting out a study that talked about how important it was to make some of those investments ahead of time, as opposed to the multi-billion dollars that you have to spend after the disaster. There's alignment there. All of my mayors agree with that, that they would rather spend $1 billion now than to spend $10 billion on cleanup. not just because it's the fiscal correct thing to do, but also because it just, you know, it saves lives and it's just also just downright commonsensical. And so I do think there's alignment there. And if we can actively push on that point, that there's a, and part of the reason why we're actually even here at the U.S. Conference of Mayors is to make some of those points to help to further unite some of our mayors around those points so that we can go together under one voice to the administration for us to be able to work together around those issues.
Now, when Donald Trump came in a year ago, there were lots of questions about, you know, what would happen about the issues of migration, and that many people were going to supposedly be sent, you know, away from the cities they'd called home for many years back to nations they didn't even know. And we're seeing this happen a little bit with people from Central America. There's the big question mark against what the future of the Dreamers are. Again, has that issue begun to find a way to be resolved? Or is that one of the more contentious things that still exists between many of the cities who want to ensure that they care for and protect the people who have called their cities home for many years and Donald Trump?
There's definitely some disagreement between our mayors and the administration on this point. On issues of the refugees and immigration, many of our urban cities, their economies are very dependent on the immigrant population and the strength that they bring, the taxes that they pay, the economic value that they bring through their hard work and willingness to contribute to the growth and sustainability of our cities. And so, you know, you look at Pittsburgh, where, you know, as the president began to say that he was less open than we have been in the past. The mayor of Pittsburgh said, we are open for business and accepted many refugees. The refugee issue, the immigration issue is one example, right, where mayors have had to step up in ways that in the past the federal government has been the voice for the nation. And I think what you're seeing is the mayor, where there are areas of disagreement, particularly when the disagreement is consistent with what has historically been American values, you will see our mayors and mayors across the nation really stepping up. As we retreated from the Paris Accords, you saw New York City pledge, as well as many other cities, but pledge that they would be signatories, and New York advance the point of saying that they're trying to get to zero waste. Atlanta's that to try to get to 100% renewable energy. Those are just two examples of just many cities who have stepped into the gap that have been filled by a bit of a policy shift at the federal level.
You're pointing out here how cities can act independently and can stand up to the presidency. Do you think that cities are any worse off than they were a year ago then on this range of issues, or are actually they quite good at dodging the bullet that's coming from Washington?
On this one, again, I would say it's a mixed bag. They are facing some unsuspected, I would probably say, challenges in terms of the shift from historically consistent American values on kind of key issues of immigration and climate. But at the same time, it has resulted in mayors stepping up in cities and legislative governments within cities, stepping up in ways that they hadn't previously, and recognizing the very important role, particularly by 2050, you know, 70% of the world's population is going to be in cities, right? And so that if cities are more active and activist and recognize that they have a very crucial role to play in the overall resilience, not just of their city, but of their state and of the overall country, that's a good thing. And so I again would say it's a mixed bag. There are issues where there's clear disagreement, but some of those disagreements actually has resulted in the cities being stronger and the leadership stepping up in ways that they historically had not.
And finally, as this Congress closes in the next couple of days, what would be the win that the mayors are hoping to see from central government?
Obviously, we would love to see a very substantive investment in infrastructure, particularly resilient infrastructure that is not doing things in the way that we have done them in the past, but also looking for multiple benefits so that a road is not just a road, but it's an opportunity to connect people to jobs, that we think about transportation in a way to create more equity. And so you can make those investments in the way where you're thinking about that road and about the job training and about the and about how it improves the overall region and the country as a whole. So I think our mayors are very interested in seeing those types of infrastructure investments that create jobs and opportunity within our cities. I think our mayors are also interested, would love to see the administration change course a bit as it relates to the Environmental Protection Agency and to continue down the path that it had historically taken and really being a champion for the nation as a whole around the issues of environmental protection. And then obviously, you know, just continued looks at our National Flood Insurance Program and getting smarter about it and real substantive investments in mitigation so that we are spending less money in a reactive way after the disasters, but being smarter and more strategic in terms of our investments so that we are prepared for those shocks or stresses that may come, despite whether we are calling it climate change or unusual weather occurrences.
That was Otis Rolley, who's the Regional Director for North America at 100 Resilient Cities. New York City is definitely known for being ahead of the curve, and well before the current administration, it had formed its own citywide Office of Immigrant Affairs all the way back in 1984. While immigration issues are mostly in the hands of the federal government, New York has wasted no time in doing what they can to make the city the inclusive and integrated community that it wants to be. Monocle's Charles McFarlane spoke with the Office of Immigrant Affairs Acting Commissioner, Bita Mostofi, about keeping the city safe for immigrants and how its model is spreading across the country.
Do you think New York was maybe a little bit more uniquely prepared for the outcome of the 2016 election and what the administration is doing now?
I would like to say that New York is at the forefront of what you can do as a city to be welcoming and to create an environment that's sort of lifting barriers to access to resources for immigrants. And certainly that puts us at an advantage in the face of the federal policy changes and the increased enforcement. I think a lot of that has to do with, frankly, building trust in communities. A unique part of what we've done under this administration is we actually created a team who comes from the community, who speaks varied languages, and whose job it is to be in communities talking to leaders, talking to individuals, creating access to the mayor's office for folks to elevate their concerns and their needs, and then providing in response the resources that communities are saying they need and lack.
Have you seen other cities around the country maybe looking to New York as, I guess, a beacon or maybe inspiration for how you've been able to set up here and deal with sort of them the past year?
Yeah. So one of the things that we do through our Coalition Cities for Action is share best practices with other cities. And included in the work that we've done on that front has been the city's municipal ID program, ID NYC, looking at really the ability to identify as a New Yorker, regardless of your immigration status or any sort of other vulnerable circumstance you might be in, as a pillar to declaring loudly and clearly immigration status is not the thing that the city cares about. It's not what defines you as a New Yorker. And we know that through an evaluation that we did about a year ago now, about 70-75% of the people who were surveyed who identified as immigrants said that the card gave them a greater sense of belonging to the city. We have shared our experience in the development and operationalizing of that program with other cities. We've since seen many cities start to launch their own municipal IDs, including Newark and most recently Chicago, who launched it. So that's one area. We've also shared best practices among cities around legal services and how to increase access to immigrant legal services and create programs where you can do some of that work at scale.
What is something more that could be done? What's the future of this office look like? Looking forward to more years of this administration.
You know, some of the things that we are already looking at doing is we're extremely excited about a series of local laws that our city council passed and that the mayor signed into law that we helped work on that speak to access to public property, the city's agencies for non-local law enforcement, the limitation on the sharing of information with non-local law enforcement, and the limitation on cooperation with immigration enforcement by city employees and the city generally. These are really, I think, speaking to us being at the forefront of sort of what cities can do and are doing to be responsive to increased fears and concerns from communities about what might make them vulnerable and what can the city do to ensure that if they're seeking services or resources from the city, that they can do so safely. We know that we, again, are safest, we are our strongest when all of our residents feel the most confident receiving services, going to schools, sending their children to schools, accessing health services, reporting crimes to the police. So for us, at the forefront of our mind and ensuring that we can remain resilient and that we can empower our communities is to make sure that we've solidified all of the ways in which we will protect folks and keep them safe from immigration enforcement as they're interfacing with the city.
Obviously, it's been a rather trying year, especially in your line of work. Has there been anything, though, that you've seen the past year that maybe you feel a bit reassured?
For sure. I think that if there was ever a question if immigrants were resilient and if they were empowered, that should completely be swept away. Because what we've seen in the last year is really just beautiful resilience from immigrant communities themselves and their allies. Right now, we're seeing that in the form of Dreamers, these 800,000 young people nationally who, because the president has decided to essentially threaten them with deportation, even though they've all come here as youth and through no fault of their own, even though these 800,000 have reported on a regular basis to the federal government and essentially been checked to see if they pose a public safety threat or not, they are now threatened with deportation and loss of ability to give back to our communities in the grave ways that they have already been doing. And instead of sitting at home or retreating into the shadows, we've seen this bold movement of people advocating for a legislative solution to permanently allow these young people to stay here. And the young people themselves are at the forefront of that. They're telling their stories, they're making their voices heard, and I think inspiring the rest of us, because if they can do it, if they can stand on the front lines and take those risks, then we all certainly can't shy away. We have to be right there with them, if not in front.
That was Bitter Mustafi, who's the acting commissioner in the Office of Immigrant Affairs of New York City. And she was speaking to Monocle's Charles McFarlane. Up next, Monocle's Toronto bureau chief, Thomas Lewis, takes a look at the past year for American cities.
What about Michigan? He's looking like he's got a good chance in Michigan as well. Hillary Clinton was hoping for that one.
What's happening on the floor here, people are very, very quiet. They are sitting on the floors here. They are watching these results come in.
Still chanting, "We believe she will win," down at the Clinton rally headquarters.
And she is not done yet.
Fox is now calling Florida for Trump.
The big networks just called this for Donald Trump. Hugs, kisses, chants.
And confirm that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
It was just before 1 o'clock in the morning on election night in the United States, and I was in a taxi heading towards Times Square. I'd been covering the night from an election party in Manhattan's Lower East Side, where the myriad victory parties for Hillary Clinton were emptying. Heads low, eyes glossy, the red, white and blue balloons strung outside many of them seeming decidedly less buoyant as they had a few hours before. I stepped out of the cab just around the corner from Times Square. There weren't many people around walking the streets in the early hours of that morning, but the creeping sense of defeat that had tiptoed into the bars a few blocks south of me appeared to be seeping into New York's most bustling public space too. I turned a corner and the square was packed. There must have been hundreds of people there, jammed into the pen in the centre of the square, all staring up at the large screens, their faces illuminated in the lights of the rolling coverage that were conveying what many had thought unimaginable. I don't think I'd ever been in a public space so large, so packed full of people, but that had been so silent. The collective mood of disbelief, shock, that in those early hours words couldn't really translate, appeared to be so unified. Public spaces in many US cities have played a particular and peculiar cameo role in the drama of Donald Trump's first year in office. The day after the inauguration, the country's most famous public space, the National Mall in Washington, D.C., was the setting for the Central Women's March protests. The monuments along the nearly 2 mile strip that stretch between the steps of the Capitol building and the Lincoln Memorial have long been the frame for social activism in the U.S. But public spaces across the country, roads, parks, public squares, have come to life in a way that has been particular to the opening year of Trump's presidency.
Women united will never be divided. Women united will never be divided.
Less likely protest venues have emerged too since Donald Trump took office. Airport arrivals and departure halls saw thousands of protesters flock to them after the signing of the so-called travel ban. These spaces became political symbols in ways they have rarely become before, totems that were alive to the new political realities of Trump's America. Other civic spaces have also garnered new associations in Trump's first year. The city of Charlottesville, Virginia, and its picturesque university campus will for some time be associated with the darker chapters of Trump's first year. The results of the 2016 election, as blurred as they were by the peculiar structure of federal politics in the US, the Electoral College versus the popular vote, laid down a clear dividing line between city and elsewhere. Metropolitan centres in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Florida were largely blue on the electoral map, while the seep of red into the more rural parameters, or in and around those urban centres that had felt the erosion of industrial decline, emerged pretty swiftly from the edges of the city walls. But beyond the public protests in cities, several city halls too have used the quieter tools of politics to assert their place in Trump's America. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, has been the most vociferous in stating that his city and the state in which it sits should forge its own path. American cities have often been the amphitheatres for social and economic upheaval that has eventually filtered out into the country at large. The results of the 2016 election may have flipped that order, but the discontent or even approval of the current political mood in the US played out as they continue to be in public spaces in US cities across the country, speak to the peculiarities of the times the US currently finds itself in.
Every single day, your job as an American citizen is not just to fight for your rights. It's to fight for the right of every individual that is taking a breath, whose heart is pumping and breathing on this earth.
For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Before we head off, let's look at Los Angeles since Donald Trump became president, and I am now joined by Alyssa Walker, who's the urbanism editor at Curbed. First of all, LA was one of the cities that spoke up very on about its fears of a Trump administration. It has many people, for example, from Central America, some of whom are being threatened with deportation. It's done a lot to try and, you know, speak up for its community. So what has it been like that first year of having Trump on the other side of the nation?
God, has it already been a year? The longest year of my life. We definitely have a lot more to write about now, I guess, as far as urban policy. So that is interesting to explore. Living in California, you know, it's almost like we're in a different, I don't want to say a different country, but we're on this very united front, I think, against the federal government for the first time. Although some people do want to make California its own country, I've heard. But what we, I think, have kind of seen with our legislators, and especially the mayors of our big cities, is this real rallying cry to just go after any policy that is seems like it's kind of specifically trying to attack California, you know, these liberal coastal communities. But things like, you know, the tax bill that very specifically is hurting places that have high real estate costs. And that's, you know, very specific coming to a place like California. Immigration, it's very clear that our communities are some of the most diverse communities in the country, and those are being attacked. Climate change, we have very progressive, you know, climate policies, and something like this solar tariff is going to really hurt our economy. So it feels personal.
Those tariffs, for example, will hit California. But in the meantime, most of the big metropolitan cities have said, look, we're going to still abide by the Paris Agreement. We're going to make sure that our cities become greener, cleaner, more sustainable. You have done a lot in California about trying to get people to use, even in Los Angeles, more public transport to get better vehicles. So in that sense, do you think that Los Angeles can sidestep some of the fallout from the US pulling out of that as a signatory from that agreement?
The very great thing about California and Los Angeles and San Francisco, you know, we have a very strong governor, Jerry Brown, who has been an environmental steward for both times he's been in office for decades now. So he's really headed a lot of this off and seen a lot of this coming and has already, you know, plunged us into these very progressive policies with very far-reaching benefits for everybody in the state. So I think in that case, yes, like there's a lot of things that we can do where we're just going to say our vehicles are going to be cleaner. We're going to build more housing near transit. We're going to help communities become more walkable and bikeable. And we have a lot of autonomy to do that. Where it starts to get more complicated, you know, is the thing like the solar tariff where we're talking about, or where we have instances where we rely more on the federal government to provide things like subsidies or other incentives for people to make these changes. And if we don't have those, for example, through something like a tax bill, we're not going to be able to get people to pay for these changes because some of these things are going to cost a little bit extra money, you know, on the outset. So what I'm worried about is things like, you know, yes, we have a gas tax, for example. We just put in a more aggressive gas tax to tax gas and have some of that money go towards transit statewide. But then the federal government, for example, wants to try to maybe stop all these states from having their gas taxes. And that's going to cause a problem.
One of the people you have to deal with who hasn't had that many views in a way is Ben Carson, who heads up the Housing and Urban Development Organization, HUD, in Trump's administration. He's been roundly criticized in many quarters for not being a great leader and for following Trump's line too often. But before we came on air, you were saying to me that you think that he's beginning to reveal his hand a little bit and maybe changing a bit too.
I mean, I hope that the right people are maybe getting to him and maybe convincing him of the really deplorable, if I must use that word, housing crisis that the cities have been plunged into. You know, American cities have homelessness crises that are confronting each one of them. And it's not just people who are being pushed out onto the streets, but it's people who are, you know, teetering on the edge of being evicted, can't pay their rent. We have people who can't move into homes because there hasn't been enough housing being built for the last few decades. So the housing crisis is probably the biggest problem that the country is facing right now. And it seems like there's two issues happening at HUD that are very worrisome. A lot of people have left. A lot of these career public servants who have been working on these issues for a long time have checked out because they feel like nothing is being done. And none of the policies that were put into place under the Obama administration have been followed up on. And then, you know, he also recently, Ben Carson, who was an African-American, had said that he wanted to roll back some Obama policies that were about specifically undoing some of the systemic racism that has been part of our housing policy in this country for decades. There's areas of cities that have suffered from not having enough investment for years and haven't even had basic infrastructure. And some of these policies were hoping to reverse that. You know, he kind of said that he didn't think we should keep up on those policies. But then very recently, and I'm talking very, very recently, he kind of said that I don't agree with Trump on everything. I don't agree with the president on everything. I have my own ideas. So I don't know if that's a sign that all of a sudden he's going to maybe roll out some smarter, affordable housing policies and maybe address this big problem that all cities are facing.
That was Alyssa Walker, who's Curbed's urbanism editor, and she was just joining me on the line from Los Angeles. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rebello, is researched by Charles McFarlane, and it was edited by David Stevens and Christy Evans. To play you out of this Donald Trump special of The Urbanist, a song for all US cities, here's Gloria Gaynor with I Will Survive. Thank you for listening, city lovers.